Beyonce, Aneem, Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Métis writer Katharina Vermette traces her lineage in poetry in her new collection, Procession, exploring how to be a good ancestor.
I mean, that is something I did to be a good ancestor. You know, I want to give back my children their languages so that they can pass theirs to their children and that they're no longer lost.
Stephanie Sinclair wants to fill silence with story.
Canada didn't make space for survivors to share their stories in the 80s and the 90s. And so we did grow up with a lot of silences, and there weren't the same entryway to that history and to that culture.
Stephanie and her sister Sarah are sending Indigenous letters to future generations. They say it's a way to replace shame with celebration.
We really see it as our generation's responsibility to reclaim what is still there and to pass on more to the next generation.
Today, how to be a good ancestor and the stories that help us share language, legacy, and love. Sarah and Stephanie Sinclair both work in stories, one as an oral historian and the other a publisher. But the sisters grew up in a lot of silences. Their paternal grandfather, Elmer Sinclair, survived Indian residential school. It's a story he never shared. Shame kept him silent. A shame and silence he passed on to his seven sons, including their father, Douglas. In comparison, Sarah and Stephanie's maternal grandmother, or Bubby to the girls, was an open book. She was a German-Jewish refugee and often shared stories about her childhood, the war, the Holocaust, the survival. Stories that helped her to heal. That was the spark for the sisters that led to You Were Made for This World and the Steady Brightness of Being. Sarah, Stephanie, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, I didn't want to give too much of the story away. Can you pick up the thread for us and share how these two beautiful anthologies came to be?
Yeah, I was part of a group organizing a publishing event called Decolonizing Publishing, where we really sort of looked at storytelling and all the like amazing work forward that had happened in Canada, but also we're trying to like bravely have frank discussions about all the work that was yet to be done. And it was close to September 30th, and I like attempted to have a conversation with my son Cole, who was starting kindergarten. And it felt like a real kind of parenting win. I told him about my mushroom and how he'd gone to residential school and the impact that that had had on our dad. And, you know, a part of why it's so important to me that they really, that Cole understands his own indigeneity. And I thought, you know, this is such a parenting win. He gets it. It's all going to go really well. And he went off to school that day. And when I went to pick him up, his teacher pulled me aside and said, you know, I have to tell you that Cole put up his hand in class today and said that he had survived residential school when he was three, but now he was happy to not be there anymore. And so for me, it was such a reality check. You know, I'm surrounded by incredibly smart people who are so engaged in these conversations. Mm. And I still was like failing at finding a way to have that conversation with my own kid. So to me, this felt like a gift. What if this anthology created, in an ideal world, if we do it really well, like an entry point for different people to have these hard conversations, which are complicated with different age groups, you know, and because so many people have different experiences, if we were able to collect, you know, a diversity of voices who can speak to different lived experiences, then it would be, you know, such an offering to so many different people.
Mm-hmm. And if I could add to that, going back to the stories of our two different grandparents, I think that I like to see these collections as a way of moving stories closer to people. Because one thing that I really find myself sharing a lot about our grandmother, whose name was Margaret Cohn Tuchur, and as you said, Bubby, to us, she grew up with us. She moved into our childhood home when I was eight, and I'm the eldest of the three daughters. And so we grew up with her stories in our home. She was a painter. She painted in watercolors. And she loved German fairy tales. And so literally, the stories in her head were in our childhood home on the walls. So it was very easy to engage with that inner life and with the culture and the stories that she wanted to share with us. And our grandparents, my grandparents, Elmer and Phyllis Sinclair, lived across the country. And as you spoke to in your introduction, my grandfather hadn't had the same invitation to share his story. You know, a lot of the writers, specifically in the adult anthology, speak about how Canada didn't make space for survivors to share their stories in the 80s and the 90s. You know, that's a really recent phenomenon that more space is being created to share those stories. And so we did grow up with a lot of silences, and there weren't the same entryway to that history and to that culture. And so I think we like to see these two books as invitations to begin sharing story and invitations to begin what can be difficult conversations.
Mm-hmm. The collections take the form of letters. A thread in the collections is ancestry. Why do you think it's important to do that, to carry that knowledge forward and those stories and keep telling them and passing them on?
To continue the culture, to continue the way of being that has existed here for much, much longer than Canada and much longer than the United States. And I think, you know, we've been thinking about this as well so much with the two books. And of course, yes, one is for adults and one is for kids. But I think there's also sort of a looking back and a looking ahead. Mm-hmm. I think that so many of the letters in the adult anthology do speak to where silences may have occurred, to some of the challenges that people experienced in the continuance of culture, in the passing down from one generation to the next because of the intentional acts of colonialism that sought to interrupt that transfer of culture and story. And so I think we see ourselves as being part of this generation and our father's generation as well that's really sought to turn that around. And of course, there are people who grew up, you know, much closer to story than we did, and that's you know, a different story. But for us, you know, with our father and with ourselves, we really see it as our generation's responsibility to reclaim what is still there and to pass on more to the next generation.
Yeah. Sarah, tell me about Tamara Podemski's piece and The Army of Ancestors.
Yeah, I love her. I love her piece so much. I love the imagery in her piece. She speaks about how we can move from having a kind of knowing in our head. She knows that her ancestors are always with her. And then she describes in the most beautiful visual language how she had this moment in, of all places, a falafel shop in Toronto. Mm-hmm. She was a professional dancer at that stage of her life, and she was working with a group of women who she'd come to know and trust during a rehearsal process. And they'd broken for lunch and they'd gone for falafel. And one of the women that she was working with started to share this story about a time that she'd been in prayer and ceremony in the sweat lodge, and how she stayed in that lodge during a break, and how she looked at the eastern door and all of a sudden saw this forever line of ancestors, face upon face upon face, gazing at her. And Tamara absorbed that knowledge and that image, and in that moment what had been like a head knowledge for her became a full-bodied knowledge. She suddenly knew, oh, now I will always know for real in my heart, in my body, that my ancestors are always with me. She knew it in an embodied way all of a sudden. And yeah, I just found that image so powerful.
That is a powerful image. I love it. Mm-hmm. So how are these two books and putting them together and putting them out in the world helping you to confront the silences of the past in your family?
I think, you know, for me, it's been like it's rebuilding a bridge to establish a sense of self that I don't think I'd given myself permission to have before. It's not, you know, because of my grandfather or because of some of the silences that we grew up with. Though I do think, you know, it's important to mention that, you know, Bobby, who lived with us, did Tales of the Shoah, which was an oral history project, probably one of the maybe it's not one of the first, but it was a huge oral history project for Holocaust survivors. And she recorded it in our living room. And so we sat with her. We listened to her tell her story. And, you know, with our grandfather, it just felt, for me, like it wasn't safe to ask questions for him. Like it felt like it wouldn't have put him in a safe position. I think that on some levels it did feel like it was safer for both our grandfather and for our dad to just sort of understand that there was shame and there was tension and to not push it, you know. But then over many, many years, like, our dad has also done incredibly important work in terms of, like, rebuilding accountability and identity around indigeneity. He runs a website called Indigenous Watchdog, which holds the government accountable to the 94 calls to action. So he has sort of given himself permission to take up more space with his own indigeneity, mm-hmm. as we have too. And I do think that both of the books for me also, you know, came at a time where it gave me the chance to really celebrate the gift of, like, having relationships with so many talented, wonderful thinkers, you know, who came to the task of letter writing with such open hearts, you know. And there are a lot of, you know, incredibly talented writers who don't necessarily want to share everything about themselves on the page. But it did feel like with this specific exercise, everyone really came to it with such an open spirit. And that for me was an invitation to really think about my own openness around the challenges that I've had and my own, like, inability to have the conversations that I've needed to have within my own family and within my relationship with my kids, and you know, to embrace who I am. And I think, you know, Sarah and I, growing up in Toronto and away from culture and community for a really, really long time, I was sort of plagued with the question, you know, am I Indigenous enough? Am I Indigenous enough to count? You know, but then also having the family sort of inheritance that we do, our indigeneity did have huge impacts on us all growing up. So It was a really complicated question for me. And, you know, as I began to see our dad begin to have certain conversations, it gave me space to have certain conversations and to embrace the fact that I am Indigenous enough, even if my experience looks very different from many others.
And how did you eventually come to learn about that history, you know, the residential school, the service in the Canadian Army, and the shame, and ultimately come to accept your indigeneity?
When I was listening to Steph speak, I was returning to that sort of analogy or the image of our home again. And, you know, I remember when we were kids, my dad had the book Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, right? And his bookshelf has changed so much over the years, and the walls in the home that they now live in have changed so much as he's been gifted beautiful pieces of Indigenous art. He served on the board of Native Child and Family Services from the time we were kids in Toronto, and his engagement with that community has just been growing and growing and growing since the 80s. And his bookshelves are now just overflowing with, you know, everything that is printed basically by an Indigenous Canadian, he is buying and reading. And so there's more space to have these conversations at home. There's more space to have these conversations as a family because we're all learning together.
Yeah. The first contributor to the youth collection is from the late Marie Sinclair, Ms. Inighizighiban. Can you tell us how you related to Marie and what his connection to the collections are?
Yeah. Marie's father, Henry, was our grandfather Elmer's younger brother. So he is technically our second cousin. Though, you know, by relationship, we call him uncle. It's tough. You know, we asked Murray to be a part of the books just as he was becoming unwell. And he was also, you know, quite determined to finish his own memoir and had, you know, extensive conversations with Sarah about his memoir. And, you know, it's funny, Negan brought up that, you know, he really wanted Murray's memoir to start with the Ugly Duckling story because that's, you know, one of his favorite stories of Murray's. But I think as soon as Murray realized, you know, how visual the You Were Made for This World was going to be and, you know, who it was for, you know, it really is for kids, you know, and my daughter reads it, you know, she's six, and it could also be for 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds. And obviously children and education were, you know, of paramount importance to Murray. So he really wanted the Ugly Duckling story to be a part of You Were Made for This World. And I'm really grateful that we managed to do that, you know, before he was too unwell to participate.
Yeah. And in the adult collection, Stephanie, you write, you know, a deeply beautiful and personal letter to Murray that really brought me to tears. I having difficulty reading it through the tears in my eyes. Mm. Are you able to read some of that for us?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Dear Murray, I'm writing to you from Victoria. I'm sitting in a mostly empty hotel restaurant looking out at the water. It's my first time here in this city, and I wish I knew where my grandparents had lived. I wish I knew so much more than I do about their lives. I wish it had felt okay to ask questions. I'm here in part to promote your book in Vancouver next week. You're struggling in the hospital, and I've just been told by Nikon that things have taken a bad turn. I don't know what that means, but I'm sitting here waiting, hoping you aren't in pain, in some ways hoping you let go. You have fought enough. You fought so tirelessly for all of us. This morning, I went to see where my grandparents rest. They're in a beautiful garden surrounded by fountains and enormous, gorgeous Douglas fir trees. There's peace there. I sat in the rain and thought about my grandfather, Elmer, and your father, Henry, the brothers, what they endured at Fort Alexander, how they both left the school poisoned by shame and self-loathing and deep, deep trauma. I never knew Henry, but Elmer always seemed so big and powerful. My dad always retreated to a place I didn't know how to reach when Elmer came to visit, and I resented that. I remember being told why my dad feared his father, but I wasn't told what had happened, why Elmer was wounded in the first place, or how that wound had turned into rage. I had no compassionate understanding of our family history. I wanted to go see Elmer today to say that I'm sorry. I'm sorry for not asking him questions about his life before the school. I'm sorry for not helping him to remember what the school stole from him. I'm sorry for not trusting him, for holding him at a distance when he needed open arms and love so desperately. I'm sorry for resenting him, for not holding space for him to listen to his stories, to his testimony. The last time I saw Elmer was when my grandmother died. They were married for 74 years. She died weeks before their 75th anniversary. He wept and wept, sitting alone. I walked to him, took his hand in mine, and sat with him while he cried. That night, the family all went out for some food, and one of my father's brothers got drunk, angry, and threatening. He was fixated on my father and looked like a wildcat ready to pounce. Another moment when our family should have been there for Elmer, destroyed by alcoholism, rage, and shame. We all let him down again that day. It was only a few months later that Elmer died alone in a hospital room. We didn't fly back. The first time you came to Toronto for media around the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I listened to your conversation with Connie Walker, and something in me awakened. I then read and read and read, and suddenly parts of my life began to make sense in ways they had never before. Parts of my father's life made sense, and parts of Elmer's life made sense. You looked so wounded, so different from when I had seen you last. Over those years, you gave this country your health, your spirit. Did this country deserve you? I know you would want me to say yes, and that we must continue to do the work and walk the path. But today, when I think of you in that hospital room in Winnipeg, I'm angry. You're only 73. You've struggled for so many years to manage a body with so much weight of responsibility that it became too hard to carry. And I know that you're losing Catherine might mean losing you. You may not want to live without her, just like Elmer after his wife died. But before you go, I want you to know that over the last few years, as we worked on your book, I felt like I finally got to listen to our family stories and history with openness, pride, and a true understanding of why and how things turned out the way they did. I've become a better person for having spent this time with you. I'm so grateful. Your wisdom, generosity, and raw empathy have shaped our country immeasurably, and I'm so sorry that your service has come at the cost of your health, of your life. I'm so sorry for all you had to endure yourself, for the trauma you had to carry for so many others. Please know that we are a better country because of you, and we are all grateful to you for giving our community a voice and the energy to fight for survival. We are still here. Before you go, I want to tell you that I love you. I'm proud to be a Sinclair. When I saw you a few weeks ago, I showed you a video of my daughter, and you said, "Wow, that's a Sinclair face." My children can celebrate their indigeneity. They're safe. They can learn about their history and culture because of you. Before you go, I promise to honor your legacy, to continue the work, knowing it will take generations, but I will do what I can. Before you go, let me say thank you and let me promise to be tireless, to be brave, to work for change with grace, to be kind, to be good, to rise above the clouds, and think of you every time I look to the sky.
Thank you, Stephanie. Why did you want to share that, you know, start the collection with such a personal offering?
We talked about sort of what shape that introduction should have. And in many ways, given that we were asking people to be so raw and intimate with us, that maybe we also needed to bring some of our own raw, intimate feelings, you know, and that would be the right invitation to both readers and then also to the contributors in A Steady Brightness of Being, because the list of contributors is just extraordinary.
What do you hope these letters in these two collections will gift those who read them, to their children, to others, to themselves?
I'm an oral historian. That's how I spend most of my work time, is listening to other people tell their stories. And I've really come to appreciate the words of a Cree Métis writer named Samantha Nock, who speaks about the difference between being in a state of listening and being in a state of witnessing. She says, when we listen, we can be actively doing other things. We can be washing the dishes. We can be doing chores. We can be walking our dog. We can be driving our car. But when we are witnessing somebody else's story, we are giving them our complete and whole attention. We are full body. It's a full body experience. And that story becomes a part of us. And then we become accountable to that story and to the teller of that story. And so that's really become such an important part about the way that I think of story gathering, sharing story in all forms. I really hope that these two collections are both opportunities for people to bear witness to other people's lives, experiences, stories, thoughts, dreams, musings, and that people are left with the question, and now what? You know, just as there's so much conversation around land acknowledgements, right? What is a land acknowledgement if it doesn't also come with a, and now what? You know, I think that I've come to think of stories in a similar way. We listen to someone's story, and when we listen to that story, when we read that story, there's a responsibility that comes with that. And so I hope that these books are invitations for people to reflect on that question, and now what?
Yeah. Thank you so much, both of you, for spending and sharing some time with me today.
Thank you. It's been nice.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie and Sarah are Cree, Ojibwe, and German Jewish. They are the co-editors of the anthologies You Were Made for This World and A Steady Brightness of Being. Stephanie is a publisher at McClelland and Stewart, and her sister Sarah is an oral historian. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Still ahead, Procession is the third poetry collection by Katharina Vermette.
I do believe in caring for your loved ones, is the, like, caring for our children or those people who come behind us, those people who we care for. I think that's the greatest action of the revolution.
The Métis writer explores what it means to be both a descendant and a future ancestor. Speaking of our future generations, the latest album by Snotty Nose Rez Kids is a vision of the future where Indigenous youth are thriving. Featuring Australian Indigenous electronic music duo Electric Fields, here's the title track, Red Future.
know nothing about this cue. I know savages and brutes and the fruits of a label on the pockets of their suits. Red future. And nothing here is new to us. We've been on the rise from a birth to a funeral. Future ancestors, my people so beautiful. This movement been real. Front line to the studio. Look at your reflection. Tell me what you see. Your future's in the mirror. Nothing coming in between us. Now I'm praying on my knees for my nephews and my nieces. Man, we always had the vision. You're the ones who wouldn't see. We're the ground movers. Earthshakers, no savior. While they're praying on us, we've been building something great. And if we never meet again, let me do you one favor. Let me pray for you. You a gift from Creator Red.
Panic. I earn my pennies, hear the heart the way you feel the magic. Cause I can see the head illuminate, I'm pulling a rabbit. You want the vision, boy, you better learn some mathematics. I see the rest up in my rear view now. Had to move a couple mountains just to get up out of town. And it took a whole village here to raise up the child. So create a blessed kid to rock the medicine now and make us proud. Say my prayer out loud. Give me guidance, give me love. Give me strength from up above. Give me courage and protection and the blessing over us. Like you finna tell me, boys, don't cry when a warrior knows. Enough. Had a rough situation, tough, but the spirit shining through. Creator knew the world needed one of you. Cause the future looking bright and real sacred as the youth's red future.
That is Snotty Nose Rez Kids featuring Electric Feels and Red Future. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we are sending love letters and poetry to our future generations. You are only here to honor your ancestors and prepare for your children. This teaching has been on Katharina Vermette's mind lately. Through the ups and downs of birth, grief, and renewal, the Red River Métis writer has been asking what it means to be a good future ancestor, how to learn from those who came before and make space for those who come after. Katharina explores these questions in her upcoming poetry collection, Procession. Katharina, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what prompted you to reflect on your ancestry and your future as an ancestor?
Well, the book came out about over 7-8 years even, maybe. I mean, how many things happen in 7-8 years? Part of the beginning poems of the book were written when I had my daughter. I had a daughter 8 years. She's going to be 8 years old because I'm so old. And then it also, I was writing those poems through COVID and all of the things that happened during that time. So it was such a mixed time when I was caring for young children. I also had a son who was born 5 days before lockdown. But at the same time, I was surrounded by so much mortality, not only with the pandemic, but also with the many crises that came from that and just losing elders and aunties and uncles. And it just felt like that place of midlife and that place that we are always at, actually, where we're in between caring for our children and, you know, honoring our ancestors and doing our best to rattle around in between.
Yeah. What does being a good ancestor mean to you?
That's like a really loaded question, and I don't pretend to know the answer to that. What I was thinking about a lot here was one section of the book is old photos from my family of people that came before me. One section of the book is about my children as they're being born and as I'm trying to learn these languages, Michif and Anishinaabe Mohan, that I want them to know, that I want them to grow up with, that I don't know, and I don't know because it was lost before me. So, I mean, that is something I did to be a good ancestor. You know, I want to give back my children their languages so that they can pass theirs to their children and that they're no longer lost. That's one example. The other thing is I was really thinking about that idea of honoring your ancestors or honoring those who came before you. Because the other thing I want to play with is this idea of it's not just our bio children and bio ancestors, and it's the people that came before us and the people that come after us.
Yeah.
So that includes everything. That includes this whole environmental space that we're living in all time. It includes trying to prepare and honor those who came before you, who mean something to you, who have taught you something. And how do I take those teachings and hopefully do something meaningful with them, or, you know, live a life at least that they would be proud of?
Yeah, yeah. What if we're, you know, messy ancestors? Oh, the stories I could tell.
Oh, my gosh.
Of our antics alone, my friend. What are they going to be saying about us in the future?
They're going to be saying nothing about us because that has all died in this cone of silence called the early 2000s. That's in there, too. Like, when you think about the, like, we're imperfect people. We make a hell of a lot of mistakes. And, I mean, maybe this is a midlife thing, and maybe it is, you know, I was going to say it, maybe this is a perimenopausal thing, where you start to, like, there's so much they talk about perimenopause and this era of being in your 40s as a, you know, person with a uterus, and how we go through this rage, and we stop caring for folks, and we stop, like, you know, having that maternal instinct. And that all happens. There's a little bit of, like, we stop caring about things. But there's also, like, this, I think, incredible humility for the younger person we were. We're able to reflect, hopefully, with kindness to ourselves, that we can say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. But also, that came from a time when we were healing something or we were wandering around unhealed, you know? So it's, I try to be an ante to my, like, former self whenever possible. And I try to, by all means, do a hell of a lot better than I did. Yeah.
I love that. You write about the small actions, you know, that we take that can bring about change. Do you think, you know, these small actions that we do as aunties, as community, will be enough to leave the world we want for our next generation?
I mean, there's so much in this whole world where nothing ever feels enough. You know, it feels like we're kind of surrounded by so much devastation and war and things that feel incredibly hopeless. And you want to change all that. You want to, like, change absolutely everything. And then you feel powerless. You know, I was having this conversation with my friend, and she was talking about how she can't watch the news anymore because she feels powerless. And I feel the same powerlessness. I understand that. But I also can't stop watching the news. There's a bear witness quality to knowing what the hell is going on. And sorry, I'm swearing. I do that. So there is that, like, how much can we do, you know, is this constant question as we're confronted with these things. But at the same time, I do believe in small kindnesses. I do believe in caring for your loved ones, is the, like, caring for our children or those people who come behind us, those people who we care for. I think that's the greatest action of the revolution, you know, making sure that they're empowered and that they know that they're supported no matter what they're doing and no matter where they're going on their journey, and that we trust them and that they're, you know, so much cooler than we were at that age. I think that's, you know, that in itself will change the world, however slowly. And however much we can't do, we can do those little things.
Yeah.
So absolutely. I do believe in both.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, your ancestors, you know, you have a very proud Métis history in your family and other parts of your family also you speak on. What inspiration do you take, you know, from your ancestors for your own ancestorhood as you move forward?
Here I think of my grandma, my mamère, only because her photo is, like, right in front of me. And she's someone who passed so many years ago. She passed when I was 13, which is many, many, many moons ago. But she still has a legacy. You know, she still has, she has, like, I think 3 or 4 grandchildren named after her. You know, we still talk about her raisin pie. We still talk about just, you know, her humor. I remember I wrote a poem about her and all the things I was thinking about. When I think of her, and I have vivid memories of, you know, rolling cigarettes and, like, cleaning my face with Noxzema and watching her burn pies as she's, you know, howling to Coronation Street. You know, it's still there. She's still around. She's still making a difference. And it, again, it's one of those simple legacies of she cared for those around her. You know, she made a difference where she could. She had seemingly a small life, but it was actually kind of huge. And we all, like, we should all be so lucky. And I think there's so many, we're surrounded by those kind of people who just have these, like, really big lives. And, yeah, I like that. I would be honored to have even a fraction of that. 35 years after my death. Wow.
The math is mind-boggling. Speaking of those photos that are piled nicely in front of you, that's one of the beautiful things about your poetry, Kate, is that it is so vivid in describing you. I know what that picture looks like because I read your poetry about it. So as you're looking through, you know, those family photos, tell me about, you know, some of the photos that you brought to share with us.
So which one you want me to describe?
Well, I don't know. Let's start with your
mamère. I start with my mamère. My mamère, so I wrote a poem about her, all the things I remembered about her. And then I have this wonderful picture of her within this, like, you know, just her being goofy, because she was actually a really goofy person. And she has this white shawl, and she's running through, it's actually St. Patel Park, so she's in amongst the elm trees or the oak trees or whatever it is there. And she's just kind of flapping her arms around, but, you know, it looks like an angel. It just has these little white flappy things behind her. And her in a really silly moment. Like, what's not to love about that? What's not poetic about that, I think?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's the next picture you got? Hand me the mamère picture.
Hand me the mamère picture. While I was doing this, these photos as a project, because originally it was going to be, I thought the whole book was going to be just photographs. But I had spoken with a photography professor at U of M, and she was talking, her book is called Framing Identity. It's this wonderful kind of, you know, academic exploration of early photographs, like turn of the century photographs. And she talks about how women and matriarchs were so often the takers of photographs. And in doing that, they kind of framed and curated this idea of their life, their lives, and as well their children's lives and their husbands' lives and their greater families' lives. And in doing so, the contribution they made to culture and how we understand these people now is enormous and absolutely invaluable. All of these photos but one would have been taken by my grandmother. So it would have been like her way of seeing the world. And she was really invested in taking pictures of her family. You know, she really wanted her children to succeed. She was a very light-skinned person. Her husband was dark-skinned. She was always really worried about that. She also made sure her son spoke perfect English. They all had to be employed at a certain time. And whenever they were in photographs, even from a very young age, they had to be dressed to the nines. And, you know, you can see we have a bunch of family photographs where you can see my grandfather just kind of like, you know, poised for a whack across the head as, you know, these kids are like just stuffy in their little shirts and ties. But she was so invested in their success. And that is something that, you know, she succeeded. Her children all, you know, married well, had their good jobs, you know, had, you know, what her definition of success meant. So
So she curated the photos as well as curating their lives.
Exactly. She made it happen. She made miracles happen because she was born into enormous poverty and all of the challenges that, you know, she endured. She was born in 1912 in Marchand, Manitoba. So she went to St. Joseph's Academy in St. Boniface. Of course, dropped out because I don't imagine it was a very positive place for her. You know, as much as she was light-skinned and very passing, she was also very much a country Machif person, trying to push herself into this very Catholic French St. Boniface Academy. And she ended up working at a pool hall when she was like 16, which is where she met my grandfather. So, you know, she sounds pretty cool.
She does sound pretty cool.
She sounds pretty cool. But yeah, but she, so for her to own a house, for her to, you know, be able to have like, you know, her husband take care of all of them financially, and she took all care of all of them in every other way, you know, to have her sons graduate high school. Like these are amazing accomplishments that she was able to do.
Yeah. You know, in any time, but particularly that time, right?
Yeah, in that time. Well, they were, they didn't stay in, like, St. Boniface. They really felt run out of St. Boniface at that time, because in the 30s and 40s there was a lot of colorism. My grandfather was a quite dark man, and they ended up moving outside of the city because they felt persecuted. Mm-hmm. They felt like, you know, everybody was treating them poorly, and I don't doubt that they were being treated poorly in that time especially. But she endured, and she made it through.
Good woman.
Solid person.
You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. My guest today is Katharina Vermette. Her new collection of poetry is available September 30th. From that collection, Procession, this is Ma Mère.
Ma Mère, you never talked about your secrets, the bad things you held superstitiously close, as if giving voice would only let them out. Lost your mom so young, moved to the city for school, didn't finish. Married too young, baby boys all in a row, twin boys who died at birth. We don't even know their names. Only that you refused to return to the hospital the following year. Our next uncle was born at home. In the flood of 1950, when the river pushed too close, you left that house never to go back, never to live so close or trust the water again. You lost husband and son the same year. How is this you? These sad, empty facts. But your kneaded dough made too quick and lumpy. Your burnt raisin pie, so good it still raved about. Your the Coronation Street omnibus every Sunday morning. All the characters you knew better than your own cousins and talked back to, yelled at, cried with. Your detailed lessons on how to roll cigarettes just so, not too tight, but I always did. And you only smiled, smoothed the stuff tube between your fingers, sprinkled out the extra tobacco, carefully piled the medicine, and swept it back into the pouch. You're absolutely nothing ever wasted. You're an eczema on a nightstand, stale scotch mints on the table by the door in a fancy glass bowl with the lid always on. You are long, sleepy jokes that made no real sense but made you laugh too hard before you even got to the punchline. You are full belly laughs, the kind that get into everything, even bad things, never let out.
That is Katharina Vermette with a poem from her latest collection, Procession. We'll get back to my conversation with the Métis writer after a little music break. This tune is the latest from Umbagize. The group was formed by Daniel Monkman of Zune and Adam Sturgeon of Status Non-Status. Here is Umbagize now with Laminate the Sky.
Lay
that is Umbagize with Laminate the Sky. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Let's get back to my conversation with Katharina Vermette. Her latest collection of poetry is called Procession and comes out on September 30th. She says many of the poems are inspired by family photographs.
On one hand, I think that it's important to me because this is what I'm thinking about and I'm obsessing about and what I love. On the other hand, I think as writers, as poets, we have this compulsion to share what we love and what we want to talk about in the hopes that other people can relate to that, in the hopes that it connects with someone else. You know, that's why we do this work. We do it because we have to. And we're just drawn to the idea of creating something. And then we also put it out there in the world, hoping that someone else can relate. Because we all have families like this. We all have, you know, matriarchs and patriarchs and, you know, all sorts of people who came and built something for us. We're only here because of their actions. And so for me, honoring my mamere, honoring my dad and my auntie, and all those people who, you know, literally walked through hell in order for me to have this beautiful life that I have, that's a gesture we can all do. And that's a gesture we've all experienced. So if it leads to someone else honoring their ancestors or, you know, not doing high school teachers' work for them, but maybe it's a project of everyone bringing in their family photos, you know, while we read this poem and, you know, write more poems or something like that. You know, like poetry begets more poetry. You know, writing is a conversation that we have with one another as we share books and share our stories, you know. So it's... Yeah. Yeah.
Poetry teachers, English teachers, note, stop English making poetry notes. Boring.
I'm like giving you the curriculum right here. You know, just take me up on it.
Absolutely. That would be a beautiful project. What about your kids? What do you tell them about their ancestry and how do they wear it?
My kids are wearing it really, really well these days. It sounds funny. I'm just so incredibly proud of them. I have two batches of kids. I have older kids in their 20s, and then I have young little babies who are almost 8 and 5. And my 20-year-olds, like, I just love watching them fly, you know? My oldest is, this is my bragging rights, she's about to go into grad school in environmental sciences, and part of her work is all around food sovereignty and the reclamation of indigenous food practices. It's so exciting. I'm so proud. I'm like beaming with pride. You know, my son, who is also in his early 20s, he's writing and kind of reclaiming this journey of his, like his cultural journey as well as his like gender identity journey and all of the things. And he's just doing it with so much more ability and pride and taking care of himself than I did at 24. And when I was 24, I also had two other humans to take care of. And I don't know how that happened or how we ever survived. But I'm full of pride looking at them. And it's the same thing with my nieces who are coming into their adulthoods. And even my little kids, you know, that are finding joy in what they love and, you know, finding this emotional intelligence that I wouldn't have even thought of when I was 48, never mind 8. I'm just so excited to watch them.
Yeah.
You know, and then take a nap because I don't have to do it. They got the world. The world is good. I'm going to go take a nap.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do. And what do you hope that they in turn, you know, after their naps when they get to our age, what do you hope that they are going to pass on to their kids?
God, these days, I just hope that they can live in when they get to be my age, that they can live in peace, that they have, you know, an environment that can still feed them. If it's left up to them, I think they will. I think these young people know how to heal this world in ways that, you know, the rest of us or those who have come before us have really fucked up. I really hope that they know that they come from, you know, all of this strength. Because all of this strength and all of these things that our forebears had to endure, you know, we have that too. You know, it's what is that they say? As much as it's intergenerational trauma, it's intergenerational strength. It's intergenerational love and all the other good things, you know. Yeah. So we still have that. Still around.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming in and visiting me today, Kate.
Thank you for having me, GMRC.
Katharina Vermette is Red River Métis from Treaty 1 territory. She's the author of many books, including a new collection of poetry, Procession, coming out on September 30th. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, Amanda Gear, and Zoe Tennant. You can now listen to Unreserved streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ginanaskimit Nawau. Agusay.